So those are all flowers right on the A mountain that I just went to run for just before the class. So hopefully you will actually get out during spring break. We actually have spring in Arizona compared to other places. So my schedule today is to do scheduling. But before that, we will look at the if there are any questions on the temporal CSPs. I can answer them. I mean, there are certain, by the way, I added this stuff on candidate set semantics for temporal planning based on the discussion that, I mean, I just did a discussion in answer to Tuan's questions last time. So I added some slides, mostly just to summarize what I said, so you can look at that. Are there any questions on temporal CSPs? That we talked about last time. Any of this rings a bell? The one thing that I pointed out is the main operations in solving temporal CSPs ultimately are, the main interest is to find the minimal constraint network, because you can't just find all the solutions. There are infinite number of them, okay? So you try to find the minimal constraint network, and that operation involves just intersection over the two operations. To do the minimal constraint networks, all you need to do is repeatedly do these operations, intersection over constraints and composition over constraints. And in particular, you do path consistency, which is if there is a constraint between X and Y and Z, you can then compute the constraint between X and Z, okay? And having computed the constraint between X and Z, then if there already exists another constraint between X and Z, you take the intersection of those two to get the new constraint between X and Z, and then continue doing this until no more constraints change. That's the basic idea in computing the minimal constraints. Okay, and the intersection operation and composition operation are quite easy, especially if you only have one interval each. If you are if you're taking the intersection of one interval with another interval, that's very easy. You just look to see what's the part on the timeline that they intersect, okay? And composition is exactly adding the start points and the end points, okay? What would be more interesting, of course, is if there is disjunctive constraints, in which case intersection is still the same, composition can lead to an increase of number of constraints, number of intervals, okay? And then this is the most important slide in understanding temporal constraint satisfaction problems. As I said, all you wind up doing is, you pick three ijk vertices in the constraint graph, and then you compute the path consistency over them, and they intersect with their existing constraint, okay? And you keep doing this, and so this inside loop only goes n cube times, because you're taking three vertices over n vertices, okay? However, you have to continue doing it until the constraints don't change. For simple temporal problems, you can show that you never have to do this inner loop more than once. Okay, in particular, you're guaranteed to reach a fixed point by the time you visit each constraint once. Okay, that's the advantage. That's why it actually is n cube. Okay, whereas for disjunctive TCSPs, in fact, it better not be n cube, because if you can get disjunctive TCSPs to get done in n cube time, that means disjunctive orderings can be checked for consistency in n cube time. And not surprisingly, it is not n cube. In fact, you can show that it's np hard, and more importantly, in this particular algorithm, what happens is you get out of this loop and you will still have to change. You have to run this inner loop multiple times. Okay? And then one other interesting thing that does happen in terms of enforcing path consistency is that when you enforce the path consistency, the minimal network, as you are enforcing it, as you wind up composing disjunctive intervals with disjunctive intervals, you can have a blow up of the number of new disjunctive intervals that come. Okay. Now what's interesting, again, you have to understand, remember this from what I said last time, the tightness, minimal networks are defined in terms of constraint tightness. Okay. A network is minimal. Okay. If I give you a constraint network C, which is basically a constraint graph, right, over the time points, okay, where the graph is labeled with constraints. These could be disjunctive constraints, disjunctive intervals, or just a single interval. Okay. Now I would say that a C dash is tighter than C. Okay, C dash, a network, a version of this network is tighter than C, if in fact it C dash has the same exact solutions as C, and yet every constraint in C dash is either tighter than or equal to C's constraint, if you compare them one by one. Okay, and the tightness of a constraint in itself is the number of composite assignments that are allowed between, if I have a constraint between X and Y, then I have another constraint between X and Y, I can say that the second constraint is tighter if it allows fewer composite assignments between X and Y than the first one. Okay. And what happens during path consistency path consistency enforcement is you're making constraints tighter and tighter. Okay. In particular, you may think originally that there is a very loose constraint between 0 and 3. And yet, by the time you actually do the composition of these two constraints, you realize that there's one more constraint between 0 and 3 indirectly, which is basically 40-60. And then if you take intersection of 40-60 and 0-100, it becomes 40-60. And that's the real constraint between 0 and 3, not the one that you had here. And in fact, if I don't have a constraint between 0 and 3, if I didn't have an edge to begin with, what does that mean? It actually means there is a really loose constraint, minus infinity to plus infinity. If there is no vertex, that there is no edge, that means there is the loosest constraint possible. So you are essentially always having a constraint between every two vertices. It's minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay. And then when you take 40-60 and intersect with minus infinity to plus infinity, then you realize the real constraint. Okay. So what you're doing in this path consistency enforcement is making the constraint network tighter and tighter. But in doing the network tighter and tighter, the one point that I mentioned last time, and again it's worth remembering, is tightness of a constraint is a semantic property. Okay. And a tighter constraint might actually be longer to write in any given language. So in particular, basically this obviously is a tighter constraint than this, because I went from here and did path consistency to get this. Except it looks as if it's a much uglier constraint, because essentially it fragments the original interval into many, many, many small intervals that are the legal parts. Okay. So now when you do have disjunctive constraint problems, the usual way you solve them, there are two ways of solving them. Okay. If you have simple temporal problems, that means none of the labels have disjunction of intervals, then it's simple. It's actually this same algorithm works fast. Okay. And if you have disjunction, then this algorithm still works, but it is of course NP-hard. Okay. There are the textbook they mention it, but there is more in the journal paper, where there are ways of essentially finding approximations to these constraints. Okay. So here is the idea. Suppose all you are trying to find out is inconsistency of constraints. Okay. Suppose if you're trying to find out the inconsistency of the constraints. Now, you actually think that the constraint, the real constraint between this and this, is this very fragmented thing. Okay, but suppose what I did was I took this constraint and then just basically acted as if really the constraint is looser than that, it is from 1 to 46, just one interval. When I do that, I made the constraint looser than what it really is. With respect to that looser constraint, suppose the STP is already inconsistent, then it means the original network is inconsistent too. Right? So that's one idea that they do in trying to reduce the cost of path consistency enforcement while still answering questions such as, you know, is the network inconsistent? Okay. Those are basically, essentially you take a disjunctive constraint, and if you want it to just make it one single interval constraint, just take the beginning of the first interval and the end of the last interval and say that's what I really have. Okay. Obviously that's not correct. So when you say it is inconsistent, it would really be when with the loose constraints itself it is inconsistent, it'll still be inconsistent. But if you say it's consistent, it may still be inconsistent. Okay, that's the kind of thing that you can deal with. One thing that I mentioned last time quickly, and you know I'll quickly go through them again, but this is that for STPs themselves, either you can do them this way, okay, or if you don't like this idea of compositional intersection, there is an equivalent way of doing STPs, which is to convert each of these interval edges into a normal graph, normal digraph with two edges in opposite direction. So to say 0 is 10 to 21, instead you will make an equivalent graph where 0 is a real vertex, 1 is a real vertex, and this is a real graph because it's just a real weighted graph. Okay, the weights are just normal weights. Okay, and then you put a 20 in this direction, minus 10 in that direction. Okay, and then in this digraph, then the question would be finding the minimal network of this STP involves in essence finding all pair shortest path algorithm. I mean, all pair shortest paths on this graph. And if there is ever a negative cycle, then obviously that means the original network was inconsistent. Okay? So that's the basic idea. And then, you know, you can do all pair shortest path algorithm. You know, basically, it does the same n cube operation, except it does it directly in terms of edge costs, you know, edge weights, instead of doing actual composition over intervals. Okay, that's the basic difference. And so, you know, for that particular graph, you know, shortest path, all pair shortest path would look like this if you just run that. And once I have that, I can then convert it back into intervals if I like to have the intervals back. Okay, but I also can just use this graph to answer all sorts of useful questions about the underlying STP. Such as what is the earliest point a particular activity can start, and if an activity started one specific activity started at a particular time point, what is the earliest point another activity can start, which depends on this. Okay, so all those questions can be answered with this D-graph. Okay, and D-graph is really representing the minimal network. That's why you could answer them. Okay. So for example, it's telling you in this case that if 0 is the reference point, then these numbers will tell you what is the latest time any of the activities can start. Okay, one can start as late as 20, 2 can start as late as 50, and 4 can start as late as 70. So it doesn't matter what the local constraint said, this is actually what is meant, what is actually coming through in terms of the composition of all the constraints. Okay, so you can answer the latest solution, you can answer the earliest solution. Okay, and you can and in some sense, remember that if this whole thing, just to connect it back to the temporal planning, remember last class we pointed out that if you are doing basically anything like Zeno or tempo kind of planning, then at the end of the planning, you have a TCSP. You have a temporal constraint problem. Hopefully, it will be STP. It will be a simple temporal problem. It may not be, but it would be nice if it's an STP. But either way, given that STP, then you, during the scheduling, you would, you know, scheduling of this plan, I said once I give you the STP, then any dispatch consistent with those constraints is fine. Now, you know, a scheduler, at the time when it is dispatching, it's not enough to say, well, I can polynomial time find out what's the next thing. It would be nice if it can very quickly find out, okay, what are the earliest times at which an action can be done? What are the latest times? Is there an inconsistency? Is a particular activity getting too delayed? Questions like that. And if you have the minimal network, then you have all those things answerable pretty much directly. So that's the basic point. Okay. And then we will, when you get into scheduling, we'll see again TCSPs play a role there. In fact, you could argue that scheduling really can be seen as solving a disjunctive temporal constraint problem. Okay, where it's just somebody gave you the problem directly. You know, whereas in the case of planning plus scheduling, the planner comes up with the solution which corresponds to a temporal constraint problem. Okay. Yeah, so you can do things like, so in fact, you know, finding the feasible values is sort of like the scheduling. So so you can actually talk about for each of the activities, what are all the feasible places where they can take place. And then if you know one activity actually happened, one of those activities, so for example, X1 can occur in either between 10 to 20, X2 can occur between 40 to 50, etc. But once X1 does occur, then you'll know what are the actual values X2 can occur. In terms of times, okay. And you know what's funny, what's interesting is people whose interest is just scheduling very quickly a reasonably complex temporal network spend a lot of time on just doing this part, you know, as efficiently as possible. So from the point of view of planning and scheduling, planning is P-space complete, scheduling is NP-hard. This is polynomial, so we're just happy. But then if you have a large activity plan in front of you with only, you know, temporal constraint in between them, and you have to very quickly answer whether or not there's an inconsistency, what are the possible dispatches you can do, then that would be the place where you would be focusing your attention. And there's actually, you know, these slides are, these particular slides are from Brian Williams, whose main interest is normally in assuming that a plan has been given, how do you execute it? What are the fast ways to, you know, tell the dispatch times, etc. Okay. For us, it's like we are a stratosphere compared to this level, but it's still part of the whole problem. I mean, you know, making the plan, making the schedule, executing the schedule, all of them are really part of the entire problem. Okay? Let's see. Don't print hidden slides. Okay. Any questions? That was just like a slightly slower overview of the same thing that I talked about last time. So now what we're going to do is talk about scheduling, which is kind of very nicely connected to this problem. Okay. Before we go there, are there questions on scheduling, since you guys read some stuff on scheduling? Happy faces, stunned faces. Okay. So the deal in scheduling, so here are, you know, scheduling again, just as there is no single planning problem, there is no single scheduling problem. Okay. However, for, you know, for the particular lecture here, we will talk about a specific generic planning problem and compare it to a specific generic scheduling problem. But, you know, there are conferences just for scheduling, okay? And scheduling as a problem has been solved by multiple areas, not just in the ICAPS community, which is this planning scheduling community, but the OR community has done lots and lots of work on scheduling. And then there is now also a separate conference called MISTA, M-I-S-T-A, which is, I think, something about multidisciplinary conference on scheduling. Okay. And then there are specific types of classes of scheduling for which they have their own separate conferences. For example, timetable scheduling is a kind of scheduling, and there is just a conference just for that. And so there's like, the reason I'm talking about conferences is that means there must be a community. It's hard to hold a conference with nobody there. So I assume there is like a large number of people whose only interest is doing timetable scheduling. Okay. Having said all that, unfortunately, I would basically only give you like a peek into the scheduling community's work, especially on like a very biased peek. In particular, we'll just look at how certain types of methods, for example, constraint CSP-based methods for solving scheduling. That's the only thing that we'll talk about. Even that, obviously, you can have an entire course on that. Okay, but I will at least make connections to what we are doing. And you know, in planning, so that at least you know what are the connections. You know, then you can read more. Okay. So in a way, the scheduling and the planning problem. This is the usual slide that you know people talk about. In a case of planning, you are told what to do, and you have to figure out how to do it. I'm sorry. Let me put it this way. In the case of planning, you are told what to achieve, not what to do. What to achieve. Okay, and you have to figure out what to do to achieve what you need to achieve, and then how to do them. Okay, in the case of scheduling, the you know simple form of scheduling, somebody decided what to do. You don't quite know why they are doing those. You know, somebody else, like a project manager, decided these are the activities that must be done, and these activities have certain you know precedence constraints, and they may also have certain resource requirements, which indirectly force precedence constraints. Okay, and the question, of course, then is in what order to do them, such that all the precedence constraints are satisfied and all the indirect resource constraints are satisfied. Okay, so looking at it that way, one can actually argue that scheduling is just a special case of planning. Right, in the sense that in one case you are thinking of what to achieve, I mean you're only told what to achieve, you have to first figure out what to do to achieve the things that you're trying to achieve, and then you know how to actually what order to do them in. Okay, these two problems, although scheduling can be a special case of planning, scheduling existed much before automated planning techniques existed. Because in you know there are a variety of ways I'll talk about in a minute, but suffice it to say that even if a planner did not decide what are the activities to do, somebody else, you know, some humans may have decided what activities to do, and you would then work in what all you will be looking at is looking for feasible orderings, feasible allocation of the tasks to times and resources. Okay, scheduling can be thought of as an allocation problem. Okay, where you are allocating tasks to time points and also to resources. Okay, so since you know sort of this much, this stuff on this side, let's look at this. So set of jobs, one type of scheduling. There's like again, as I said, there's a large number of subclasses of this. One version would be given a set of jobs where each job in itself might have subtasks in them. So each job might involve like 15 activities to be done in some partial order. Okay, and so you're given 5 of these jobs, let's say, or 10 of these jobs. Okay, and then in those jobs, in each of these jobs, within the job there are tasks. Okay, and there may be constraints on the tasks in those jobs. Okay, there may be precedence constraints. Okay. And then you also might have contention constraints. Each of these tasks might require certain resources. Okay. Now the question, of course, is just find start times of our jobs that are optimal with respect to various objectives. Make span, that is, from the beginning to the end of the execution of the schedule, the time elapsed would be minimal. Okay. Our resource consumption from the beginning to the end, at no point is this really costly machine being used more than, I mean, it's not used more than 40% of the time. Or its usage is reduced as much as possible. Okay. And then you can also have things like slack time. So find a schedule which has, you know, among the schedules that have low make span, find one which also allows high slack. Now, what is a slack in a schedule? The idea is, if you have a schedule where, you know, one activity stops and another activity starts, now suppose it turns out there is a failure in starting the activity exactly at the right time, okay, then if the schedule has some slack, then that means the rest of the schedule can still continue. Even though you started this activity like 4 minutes late, there is enough slack between the end of this activity and the next activity that depends on the output of this activity that you can continue. Yes, sir.
But shouldn't we have one task without slack at all?
What?
Shouldn't we have one task in the graph without slack at all?
That's the critical path, yes. So the question, of course, so if you are minimizing the make span, there is a critical path. Okay. The question would be, no, let me think whether the critical path, yeah, minimizing the make span, there should at least be one path, you know, which would have no slack. But there may be other paths, the other parallel ones can have slack, for example. Okay. And one of the big deals is that if a, you know, if a schedule with slack fails, you can reschedule without having to go all the way back to the, you can continue execution without having to go all the way back to the scheduler. Okay. One of the interesting things is, just as you have replanning, there is rescheduling. Okay. And all these issues that we talked about in the context of planning also wind up in some of the issues, such as commitments, for example. Okay. If you started an activity, then it has to end, and then you don't get to change the activity that you already started, for example. Okay. And if you reserved certain resources for certain periods of time and you already incurred the cost for that reservation, you don't get to just change the schedule completely. Okay. So rescheduling has some of the same issues as replanning. In fact, there is work in rescheduling, which is sort of related. One big difference, as we'll see today, is that scheduling ultimately winds up being closest to bounded length planning. Okay. That's the weird point. So if you are thinking in terms of what you learned in this class, if you're trying to figure out what would be like the, you know, a way to connect scheduling and planning in terms of techniques, it's sort of like bounded length planning. Okay? Because in essence, you have decided upfront how many actions are going to be scheduled. The only question is to find out the right order to schedule, you know, right assignment of resources and right assignment of start time points. Now, you remember that bounded length planning has been tried as, what are all the things we tried? SAT, CSP, IP. You can use all of them for scheduling too. And they have been used for scheduling. And one thing we remember, we talked about IP encodings obviously will support, you know, optimization for with respect to various objectives. And so in fact, a lot of work, probably more than half of the work that goes under the term scheduling, basically uses integer programming formulation. Okay. But you know, much of the work that gets done in scheduling and gets published in like the ICAPS community and the AI community tends to be more CSP oriented. Okay. And there is also a middle area now, which basically called constraint logic programming, which sort of winds up using ideas from both IP programming, IP encodings, and the constraint CSP encoding. Okay. So that the conference for that, the community which thinks in those ways is CP, which is Constraint Programming Conference, which basically people from IP, OR, and constraint satisfaction communities go and talk there. Okay. Anyway, one problem, of course, is that although ICAPS, for example, as a community, you know, they have a word letter P and a letter S, and so P is supposed to stand for planning and S is supposed to stand for scheduling. For a while, it used to be P for planning and S for systems. So it used to be just planning systems. And then the scheduling guy said, we'll stop coming to the conference unless there is a scheduling there, and so it's now called planning and scheduling. But like, you know, several other conferences, when the scheduling talks are happening, mostly scheduling people hang around, planning people tend to stand outside and talk, and vice versa. You know, there hasn't been that much close connection in the communities. They are very close problems, okay, but you know, you can't make people talk to each other. You know, the different people seem to be interested in doing these problems, and you can't make them talk to each other. This is not, I mean, ICAPS is actually a smaller problem in that sense. There is this conference in machine learning psychology intersection called NIPS, Neural Information Processing Systems. It's like a very nice conference. And it has basically a bipolar disorder. It has, you know, neuroscientists and machine learning people got together. And so they try to force each other to learn to each other, but you know, I've been told that mostly when the neuroscientists talk, the machine learning guys are catching up on the gossip outside and vice versa. You know, it's like just a happy house where, you know, different people enjoy. But, you know, hopefully, I mean, that's just the reality of it, but, you know, clearly there are connections in terms of scheduling, and I will try to, you know, the paper that I suggested you read for the class after the semester break, which I will talk a little bit about today too, essentially, you know, looks for problems that are sort of between planning and scheduling, with planning and scheduling being the two ends. And there are such problems, and we'll talk about it today in a minute, okay? And for those, the techniques you understood for planning would be useful for those problems. And similarly, if you need to understand scheduling guys' techniques to solve those problems. There hasn't been that much work there, okay? Now, let's say, so this is what I was talking about earlier in terms of why was scheduling a separate problem compared to planning, okay? There are like two different ways you can answer it. One is they existed as separate problems, okay? The real world practice point of view, historically in many domains, there were never any automated planning techniques, okay? And you can also make the sociological arguments that if the plan goes wrong, somebody's head has to roll. Okay, and you know, making FF or SNLP's head roll is just not worth it. You know, they're just systems, okay? So you would have some project manager who says, we are going to do these activities, and then somebody is only assigning resources for them, okay? So either because the planning problem is too complex or because people just wanted somebody to be blamed, you know, either way, scheduling existed as a separate problem upfront. Okay, that's just the reality. Okay, so somebody decides what actions to do in support of the company's goals, let's say, right? And then then all you do is provide automated scheduling. That's basically what happens. So the only computer support for planning activity is really given for resource scheduling. Now it's interesting that you can make a very optimal schedule of a really terrible plan, and that doesn't get you anywhere. You know, I mean, that's more or less what we do. In a sense, you know, like assignment of, you know, large scale scheduling problems are run pretty much by everybody, including airlines, you know, where they're trying to assign the pilots and the crew as well as the, you know, the really cheap snacks, etc., to each plane, and then the planes have to be assigned, the actual planes have to be assigned to fly different routes and so on. Somebody decided which routes must be flown. Ultimately, those are the critical decisions. Okay, and then having decided that, and how many times must you have a flight from Phoenix to LA? These are things that, you know, somebody decides. Having decided that, you can then talk about the optimal schedule, optimal assignment of resources, or, you know, close to optimal assignment of resources, you know, for this guy's idea. Okay, and if it doesn't work, then this guy will get fired. Somebody else will be asked, you know, how come, you know, that you are having so many flights from Phoenix to LA? Not enough people are, you know, going anywhere, and so you have to change. Okay, so that part, the action selection part, is being done by humans, and scheduling, which is a complex part, it turns out, because there is, you know, resources, you know, multiple resources, which are, you know, and basically there's the pilots' time constraints, the, you know, the crew time constraints, and in the flight availability, the plane availability, all of these have to be taken into account. Okay. So actually, when you talk about that, it's one of the dirty little secrets is, despite the fact that you can say, well, planning people, when planning as a problem includes scheduling as a sub-problem, the reality is that, as you'll see today, I know, even in temporal planning, till now, mostly we talked about temporal planning with action durations mostly. We didn't talk about resource contention at all. I did say, well, metric temporal planning involves resources, and you have to consider, you know, the contention arising from that. but there aren't really very effective techniques for handling that. Okay, so when push comes to shove, planning in the planning research, people try to stick to simpler resource models or ignore resource and assume that somebody will provide for them. Okay, and then just pick the activities. Okay, and when push comes to shove, these guys essentially cannot do that because they are given what to do already. And so they also say, well, resources will be available, I won't care about it. Then somebody has to care. Okay. So the resource constraints of the types of resource constraints that are considered in scheduling tend to be more expressive than the ones that have been considered till now in planning. Although conceptually, they should be considered here too. It's just that we don't have very good techniques. Okay. And then another reason from the automated planning, from the planning point of view, sometimes certain kinds of resources you may not know that how many resources of each type are going to be available at the execution time. Okay, and in particular, suppose you, each of us are making our plans, and then there are all those plans are going to be executed on a central factory floor, then it makes sense for us to just assume that the machines that are needed to do the various activities would be made available for us. And then you assume that and you make the plan, and then it's sort of a hierarchical view where you select your, you know, sequence of activities ignoring the resource constraints, and somebody else then finds the assignment of resources, including time points. Okay? In that view, so basically you are separating the scheduling of the actions from the planning phase. And we have argued actually that that may not be a bad idea even from the point of view of completeness for the planner, because it may be, it, you know, planners should really be focusing more on causal reasoning. Although if you happen to know upfront that in this world there's only one machine of this type which will only be available between 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock on February 29th, you know, ignoring that constraint completely from the planning time point makes no sense. Okay, anytime you ignore constraints, the hope is most of the time they will be available at the scheduling time. Okay, but there are enough cases where that is possible that, you know, you can make an argument that scheduling decisions can be separated from the planning decisions. Okay. This I already made. Scheduling sort of seems to be a bounded length planning where actions are already given to you. So you could use any of the encodings, CSP or SAT or IP encodings. More of the things that have been done in the within the like the AI community side is sort of CSP based encodings. Yes. No, they are not decoupled. So the thing is, sometimes, so they're clearly very well connected, okay? But computationally, there may be reasons. So in fact, you know, I sort of skipped over this. So even if a single agent is doing planning, it may be worth separating causal reasoning and resource reasoning for various reasons. For example, computational constraint, you know, it would be easier to separate them, okay? The search spaces for causal reasoning would be smaller, and then after you decide the causal reasoning, then you look for the optimal scheduling for that. Now, of course, when you do that, while that decoupling, you know, improves efficiency, and it can also take care of potential ideas, potential issues such as if the resource availability will not be known at the time of planning, what are you going to do? So you may as well make the plan assuming they will be made available to you, and then you do scheduling later on. Now, in all those cases, you can no longer, you know, delude yourself that you can make optimal plans, which will have optimal schedules, because you are taking liberties, right? So you can make, you know, you will make a plan assuming the resources are available, and then sometimes maybe the resources, you know, the availability of resources and the cost models of the resources might be different, and all you can do is, with respect to the plan that comes to the scheduler, the scheduler would find the optimal schedule for that. Okay. Now there's been work in integrated planning and scheduling where what they would do is, if for example at the scheduler, if you actually cannot schedule the activities, you go back, you backtrack all the way back to the planner. There is, you know, a bunch of approaches, including some work that we have done. Okay. But you know, what's more interesting in those cases would be whether you can do it while preserving optimality. Okay, failing is one thing. When you fail, you know you failed. When you are not optimal, nobody taps you on the shoulder saying you're not optimal. You know, right? At the end of your life, you'll know. But if you fail, you know that there is no, you know, resource available for this. Okay, so they're not supposed to be decoupled, but we decouple many things in our life, you know, just for computational reason. I mean, it's like clearly your school life is not supposed to be decoupled from your home life. You know, it's only one person, and you know, all your things are connected, but we separate our worlds to some extent possible so that you can work on each of them separately. But every once in a while, you know, the decoupling doesn't work and, you know, you pay for it. Okay. So same here. Okay. So this you can keep. I mean, scheduling, at least in the unary capacity resource case, is equivalent to sort of solving a disjunctive temporal network. Okay. So if I have a bunch of activities and, you know, there is a unary capacity resource, that means this resource can only be used by one activity at any given point of time. What happens when you have that? Those activities, even though, so you made a plan which requires, you know, the use of this unary capacity resource, which is, you know, this projector, okay? And he also made a plan which requires a projector. Now, you made your presentation plan separately, but they clearly have certain interesting mutual exclusion relations. You can't both start your presentation at the same time because there's only one resource, which you both need, right? So in the case of unary capacity resources, then there will be basically conflicts between activities that share the same resource. And the conflicts can be solved by either pushing one to come after or this way. Okay, that's very easy. Now what actually becomes more interesting is what happens if you have multi-capacity resources. Okay, that would be N-ary mutual exclusions. And just as we hated N-ary mutual exclusions in planning graph, we hate it in scheduling also becomes, you know, the unary capacity resource scheduling is an easier problem than the multi-capacity resource scheduling. Because when you have multi-capacity resource, then the question is there are many more ways of resolving a conflict. If you have one, sometimes if there's a fewer ways of resolving a conflict, life is easier for you. Okay, if there is, you can take, just as think about blocks world, think of a version of blocks world where there are some blocks which are bigger than other blocks. And they can keep more, up to four blocks on top of them. I mean, you have these kind of things, right? I mean, so you have big block, on top of this you can put three blocks, and then on top of those again you can put three blocks and so on. So normally in blocks world you have this idea of clear, not clear, because each block exactly has one space. It's a unary capacity resource. Okay, the moment you have multiple spaces on the block, it's a multi-capacity resource. And why don't we talk about blocks world with multiple spaces? Because they are harder problems. Okay, so it's, at least in the case of, you know, in planning we tend to kind of, you know, people have tended to look at problems which are more unary capacity resource oriented problems up front, okay, to the extent possible. I'll come back to it. But in scheduling, they don't get to say, we'll only do unary capacity scheduling, because they'll be laughed out of the room, right? Because, you know, already somebody did the hard problem of, you know, figuring out what actions to do. All you're being asked to do is, you know, schedule them to resources. And if you say, well, I only can deal with certain types of resources, it makes your life, you know, your work less. Yes.
So one of the reasons that I need scheduler is that I do not have enough knowledge about the.
That's one reason. That is one reason.
So if I have the full knowledge about the domain, about resources, so the plans returned by, for example, the efficient eco planner, where I know exactly the bottom of happiness in the scatter.
Mm-hmm. So the thing is, even if you do have full knowledge, for just computational reasons, you might try to do the problem hierarchically. Try to ignore the resources issues up front, make a plan. Yes, yes. But, so they both are important. In fact, I should go ahead and add that, you know, reasons from the automated point of view, you know, I should probably say that one is the knowledge. You know, the execution is happening later on. Normally, that's what we do. I mean, I make a travel plan ignoring a whole bunch of issues such as which specific, you know, cab am I going to take, where am I going to park my car, etc., etc. So that sort of is like the hierarchical planning, where at some point of time you stop further planning. Yes, sir.
Yeah, but if I separate them, I'm pretty much, if I fail, it's pretty big.
Yes, yes. So what do? You change the world. The world that we live in is made by us, right? So in a way, what we did was we basically changed the problem. We such that there will be fewer reasons to fail. You know, in problems where there is a tight connection, you would just solve them, you know, together, or you stop solving them, you know, either way. So, I mean, this is actually as much a sociological issue as a computational issue. I mean, why should planning and scheduling be able to survive as separate disciplines? You know, partly because we made so. You know, we actually made, you know, we make problems in such a way that, for example, suppose I live in a Lala world where there is only one specific cab driver for the entire Phoenix area. It makes no sense for me to make a travel plan if I happen to know that on that particular week this cab driver will be going to spring break vacation. So my plan doesn't work. So I cannot ignore that constraint anymore at that point of time. But I changed the world. I mean the world that we designed has enough number of cab drivers most of the time that I can ignore that. It's again, by the way, this is also connected to the notions of abstraction. Okay, when can you abstract details? You can abstract details if, in fact, more often than not, those details can be worked out later. This is this downward linearizability that we talked about. Okay, now you can learn them, or you can make the world such that downward linearizability holds more or less. Okay. But that's the best I can answer on that case. I mean, it is true that when there is, you know, once in a blue moon, you suddenly, like, you know, if you are traveling in Italy or India, you know, on the day you wake up for your thing, you suddenly read the paper that, you know, these are following people are striking today. Okay, that's it. So your plan is out the window. You know, it didn't make a difference. Okay, so now you could say, well, I should have been smart enough. I mean, the real Italians and real Indians would have kept track of what are the upcoming strikes. You know, there is like everybody has their strike schedule, and you know these people will be striking, so you should be smart enough to make a plan which would not go into that. And the foreigners will get stuck, you know, because they assume that this won't be happening. But we don't call them, you know, we don't necessarily make fun of them, because most of the time in their lives it did work to ignore those details. Okay. Okay, so having said this, one thing that we, oh my God, this is like the worst. You cannot see a thing at all, but so here in black, I can't even change it because I opened it. So here is job, I mean the next one, by the way, is in color, so don't worry. So here is your job shop scheduling, here's your planning, okay? And that's the spectrum that we had. And so now you have color, less color, but color. So the difference is on the planning, you know, this is basically like these are actually slides by David Smith, you know, that he made for the, you know, the paper you're going to read for after the semester break, after the spring break. So in the case of planning, normally the important thing, one way of thinking about it is there is causal reasoning in the planning, but another way of thinking about it is that there is cascading levels of choice in planning. You first try to figure out, if you remember, you know, once you consider start thinking about like oversubscription planning, first you decide which goals to work on. Then you decide what action to use to support one goal. The moment you decide to put this action, then it says, I need these preconditions. Now you have to sub-goal on them. And then you put some actions, and then they need preconditions. So there is cascading choice at each level in planning. Okay? In pure scheduling, which actually should exist here, but somehow it did not. Let me see if I can do something on that. Yeah. I don't know if you can see that. In the pure scheduling, here, right, there is much less, in fact, the pure scheduling, there is no choice at all. Okay? Because the actions that are given to you must be done. and there are orderings that must be respected. And then there may be resource constraints, but there is no choice in terms of whether you can, whether you should do an action or not. All those actions that are that should be scheduled must be scheduled. Okay? Now, by the way, can you think of oversubscription scheduling? Of course, you can think of oversubscription scheduling. You know, we will accommodate all the students who want to get into the class, but then if the class is becoming too big, then we start throwing away some people. Okay? Or we will try to allocate resources to all the tasks, but if the resources are not enough, and you know, and there is a strong deadline as to when the factory should be closed, then some tasks will be just postponed or thrown away. Okay. Okay. So that's the, so on this side you have no choice in the simple in the case of simple scheduling, and in the case of your cascaded levels of choice in the planning side. Now you can start having other points. So this, if this is no choice scheduling, then you have resource choices. So here these tasks might say, I could be working on this type of this machine or this machine or this machine, and my pilots can, you know, each pilot can either fly Boeing 760 and 755 or, you know, Airbus 320 and something else, because the pilots can only be, they're only licensed for certain flights. Okay, so there are different, there can be resource choices. That's like the first level, and that will introduce disjunction. Okay, and then you can have alternate processes. Okay, you might say as part of the scheduling itself that either do these actions or do these actions, or at least do 5 of these actions and 4 of these actions. Okay, then you have choice. Except the difference still is the choice here is limited compared to the choice here, which is just cascading levels of choice. Okay, and that paper that, you know, that David Smith basically argues that as the choice level increases, your scheduling is becoming more like planning, and as the choice level is reduced, planning is becoming more like scheduling, and there are interesting problems in the middle. So in fact, one of the arguments that he makes in that paper is, so alternate processes is actually a very nice scheduling problem that doesn't fall under the rubric of normal job shop scheduling, because you have disjunction there. And one interesting issue for scheduling people has been, like, they would just look at subclasses of scheduling problems and find really good algorithms just that work only on that subclass, or great heuristics that just work on that subclass. Okay, the moment you violate the constraints of that class, everything is up for grabs. You have to redesign, you know, a more efficient algorithm, or, you know, better heuristics and so on. Okay, so you can have alternate processes. You can have, you know, you look at some problem like this. You have a spacecraft which has observation choices, it has instrument choices, it has calibration target choices, it has ordering choices, communication choices, instrument status choices. Is it doing planning or scheduling? Becomes harder to answer, because this large amount, it's not just scheduling, it is also deciding what to schedule. But it's not getting to decide. That decision is circumscribed. Only certain activities are, you know, you have to look for the choice between certain activities. Okay. So one way of thinking about the scheduling and planning are as points in a spectrum. Okay. So the rest of the class, all I'm going to do is, again, as I said, there are, for every specific subclass of scheduling problems, there's actually in the IE, in the Industrial Engineering Department, they have scheduling 1 and scheduling 2, 2 courses at graduate level. Okay, and then in the end of the scheduling 1, you look at job shop scheduling, which is the one that I showed you. Okay, and so they go into each subclass, look for, you know, the best algorithms for a variety of objectives and all that fun stuff. Okay, obviously I'm skipping over all that, but, and mostly what I'm talking about here is, I'm going to look for taking a general CSP problem, modeling it as, I'm sorry, general scheduling problem, and modeling it as a CSP problem, constraint satisfaction problem. Okay, That's not necessarily the only winning way. In fact, as I said, constrained programming approaches, which you know do seem to work well, and then there's this, the big company which does all these schedulers is iLog, and they use sort of integer programming as well as the CSP approaches. Okay, but it's worth looking at least one way of doing it so that you'll get an idea. Okay, so here is a simple problem. These are the jobs, J1, J2, J3, and there are precedence relations. J1 has operations O1, O2, O3, and J2 has operations, I'm sorry, O11, O1, O21, and O31, O12, O22, O13, O23, O33. Those are the jobs. For each job, that's the structure of the job in terms of the operation. And there are some precedences. In this case, it turns out each job happens to be totally ordered. It's totally ordered. It's not position constraint. All it means is, for this job, you cannot do O23 before having completed O13. Okay? So in a central schedule, you might do O13, do this, and then do this. That's fine. That's the usual way when you are, you know, this is one place where precedence relations are absolutely required. You know, you cannot let people give you, you know, jobs which are position constrained and expect you to schedule them. I mean, imagine you go to your car guy and say, you must work on my problem from 3 o'clock to 3:15. You know, that's obviously putting much stronger constraints, because then it becomes harder to interleave it with other jobs they have. Okay. So anyway, and then what's more interesting is that each of these actions, each of these operations in this particular case have resource requirements. Okay. Now I say that directly. I will say O1 requires R1, O2 requires R2, O3 requires R3, O1 also, here also, this one also requires R1, this also requires R1, this requires R2, and so on. So all of them require those particular type of resources. These are the resource classes. Okay. And then you could basically talk about capacity constraints. How many such resources are available? You know, the simplest case is unary capacity. That means you only have R2 type resource, you only have one of them. Okay? And R1 type resource, you only have one of them. R3 type resource, you only have one of them. Okay, that's the simplest case. If you have multiple, then obviously it's, you know, in a way, the schedule can have better makespan, but the search space is going to be harder. Again, this is normal. You could actually wind up, you know, having, you know, little extra resources. So just, again, this is, think about the issues where solving a scheduling problem with very few resources, large number of resources, critical number of resources. It'll always be harder to solve scheduling problems when they have critical number of resources. That means not too many, not too little. Okay, that's when optimization becomes quite hard, and even, you know, consistency becomes hard. That's just normal. All the combinatorial problems are normally tend to have critical regions where they become hard. Okay. So that's your thing. And then the capacity constraint. If I say a number, that means those many of that resource are available. And the assumption is, you know, if this resource is being used by one activity, you can't, and another activity can't use it. Okay? If that single resource. So if you have one more copy of it, you can. Same. Okay? The other thing, and so disjunction actually occurs through capacity constraints. Without disjunction, this is quite a simple problem, actually. If you don't have resource constraints, then this is just STP, simple temporal problem. Okay. Regarding these, one other thing, of course, is these are precedence constraints, and then there are durations for the actions. You can have durations for each of the activities, so that are deterministically given to you upfront. And then you may also say for each of these activities, earliest start time, latest finish time. Which, if you don't give it to them, it will be minus infinity and plus infinity. If you do, that means this activity cannot start before the time when I give you, and it cannot end after the time I give you. Okay. Again, if you think in terms of PCSPs, each of these activities correspond to two time points, the beginning of the activity, the end of the activity. Okay. And the EST and LFT are the unary constraints, because they actually only constrain one time point. And the precedence constraints are the binary constraints. Okay. And then between, and the interaction between these unary constraints and the binary constraints will start giving you actual intervals between activities. Okay. So that's it. And then the question is, how do I, and then to make the problem harder, you can have multiple capacity resources, you can have disjunctive activities. You'll say, you can do J2 either by this or by doing three other activities. Okay? And so you can think of them as each job is being reduced by this reduction schema currently. If you have multiple reduction schemas for each job, then that is disjunctive scheduling. Okay? And then you can also have setup constraints. So for example, if you schedule task 1, you need to schedule 3 and 4. That's a reasonable idea. In fact, that's one of the ways disjunction comes in. So you might say that 3 and 4 don't need to be done. If you happen to do, you know, 1, you must do 3 and 4 before them. And you can either do 1 or 7. And if you do 7, you don't have to deal with these guys. Okay. Now, it's sort of almost like what happens in the planning graph CSP, right? When you don't have to do this action, but if you do this action, you have these preconditions, which then must be supported by some other actions. The difference is, in the planning graph, once you pick a precondition, there may be multiple actions which can support it. Here, all I'm saying is, you know, once I pick this precondition, then I do have to, I mean, once I put this action, then I have to do these two actions. That means there is no precondition choice. Okay, so just limitation of choice. Okay? So that's how you can make the problems harder. Now, in these, what part is actually harder than the temporal planning that we have seen till now? If you think of this as a subcase of temporal planning, the one thing that makes it harder is having these explicit resource requirements. Okay? And if you start having multi-capacity resources, that becomes even more interesting. Okay? And then another thing, of course, is the constraints, EST and LFT, you could actually start having utilities. You could say, for example, if the entire schedule, I mean, this action, if you, you know, instead of saying it must start, it can only start after this, it cannot end after this time point, you might say, you know, here is the region where you can start it, but as you go later and later in that region, you know, there is some penalty being assessed for you. And here is the region where it can end, but if you end later and later, there is penalty being assessed. And in fact, sometimes you can even get bonuses. You know, remember the time when California earthquake, well, I don't know whether you guys remember, but you know, 1989 California earthquake, when the Nimitz Freeway Bridge collapsed. Okay, that's like one of the main connections between the Berkeley side of the Bay Area and the Palo Alto side of the Bay Area. And so, you know, they gave a contract to a contractor, and they had strong clauses as to if you get delayed, you must pay $1 million per extra day, you know, before, in terms of construction. But on the other hand, if you get done, this is the time, this is the default time. If you get done by this time, you will get all the money, okay? If you get delayed, you will get $1 million penalty per day. And if you get done before, you know, you'll get $2 million per day extra. And this guy made it like a bandit, you know, he got like huge number of people from Kansas or somewhere and got them working very fast, and then he got done very early, and then he made more or less like half the extra money, you know, compared to the original contract. So you can have that. You know, it's a question of, so obviously he had to decide what's the optimal schedule to make given these constraints. Okay. So there are two ways of representing this problem in CSP. When you want to represent any problem in CSP, you need to decide what are the variables, what are the constraints. What are the variables, what are the domains, what are the constraints? One obvious representation is variables are start times, okay? And the domain for the start times is basically the real valued or, you know, discrete valued start points, okay? And the precedence constraints can then be represented in terms of inequalities between the start times. okay? And release times and deadlines can be represented again in terms of inequalities in the start times and end times. And the capacity constraints become disjunctive inequalities. Capacity constraints become disjunctive inequalities. Okay? So essentially what you are saying is either this activity ends or before the other activity starts, or the other activity ends before this activity starts. That's what the disjunction is. That's what makes it a non-linear programming. You know, it's not a linear program. Otherwise, it's all, you know, linear constraints, linear inequalities. Okay? So that's basically, you know, the capacity constraint. That's one way of looking at this problem. So now you have a CSP problem. You know CSP. You can solve this. Okay? Much of the scheduling work, the AI-based scheduling work, has been coming up with heuristics for solving these CSP problems. So there are like two important issues. One is what's the encoding? The other is what are the heuristics? Okay? Encoding basically tells you what are the variables, what are the values, what are the constraints. And the heuristics tell you, in CSP, what are the heuristics supposed to tell you? Variable ordering and value ordering. That's it. There's no magic. So all you need to know is variable ordering and value ordering. Okay? And in fact, variable ordering corresponds to open condition selection or the flaw selection. And the value ordering corresponds to giving an action to that. If you use that that metaphor, the big difference is, you know, once you pick an open condition, that is the variable to give the value to, in planning, of course, I mean, there are multiple ways of supporting it. But then in planning, what happens is depending on the action you use, it has its own preconditions, which can again be supported by multiple people. Here, there is no such choice. Okay? So that's why, you know, the cascading choice becomes an important thing in planning. Okay? PCP representation is the other way of looking at this. You know, where it's like there are many ways of, you know, encoding a problem as a CSP. This one is kind of a cute way where you do not care about start time. So the problem with this, of course, is what are the, so let's keep thinking about what would be the advantages of this versus this, and we'll talk about it in a minute. Okay. The PCP representation, variables are that whether the ordering between ij is precedes, follows, or I don't care. I and j are activities. The only thing that you want is it precedes, is it follows, or you don't care. Okay? So the variables are the orderings. The domains are before, after, and I don't care. And so there are n squares, obviously. O(n) squared, you know, such variables. Okay? And then, so once you figure this out, the interesting thing in this scenario is that once you figure out who is to be done before whom, in essence, you would have figured out an STP. So think of what happens in PCP. PCP takes this problem and converts, and this problem is not an STP. It's not an STP because of the disjunction enforced by the capacity constraints. What the PCP constraint solver does, it figures out for each of the actions that do matter whether they must come precede or follow. The rest, they can occur any which way. And no resource constraints will be violated. That would be an STP. And every dispatch of that STP is an executable schedule. Okay? So if this is to be a planner and this were to be a planner, this would be what kind of planner? Partial order planner. This would be what kind of planner? State space or decision epoch planner. So now you can transfer all your insights of the, you know, relative advantages, disadvantages of those two ideas back into scheduling. Yes?
I have a question. You said that it's simple to add, like if you do this. So where's the blowout?
What?
Where's the blowout in this second case? Because this is a simple problem, right?
No, I don't understand. What do you mean I said a simple problem? This is scheduling. Okay, you can solve the scheduling, this particular scheduling problem, either by this encoding or this encoding.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm not quite sure I got what. scheduling is as hard as it is. It's not, you know, it's not as hard as planning. And as you increase the disjunction, it becomes harder and harder. No, you basically no, because you do have disjunctive constraints here. Okay, like, I haven't yet told you what the constraints are. So these are the variables. This is the domain. Now, what are the constraints? Sequencing constraints. Sequencing constraints. If in the representation an activity is supposed to occur before another activity, you would say Oij is I before j. So if I is supposed to occur before, then you will just set it. Just a second. You will clamp it there. Okay. And then capacity constraints are more interesting. Capacity constraints are saying if I and J share a resource and it is a unary resource, you don't care whether I is before J or J is before I, but you do care that one of them is true. All you don't like is the concurrency. Okay, so the capacity constraints become I before J or J before I. That's the disjunction. And when you solve this problem, you would get for each of the orderings that matter, you would say this is the value. So you'd become an STP. PCPs convert a disjunctive temporal constraint satisfaction problem, which is underlying this scheduler, into an STP, which will be feasible. And all of whose dispatches would be feasible schedules. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
No, 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 I wouldn't even look. No, what I would do is if you tell me that your total number of operations are 15, then I take 15C2 variables. Okay? For each variable, now, you know, for each pair of operations, I have a variable. That's it. Okay? And then if some of them will get clamped to specific values, which means in essence they go out of the CSP. If you give a value to a CSP, you know, if for example in SAT, right, if you have Boolean variables, they can be true or false, but some of them are known to be true as part of the initial state, so you just set them true. And then once you do that, you propagate their consequences, right?
So a large situation is going to have an enormous number of variables.
Yes. But then what do you gain here? You gain each of these variables only have three values. What about these variables? They have infinite number of values. Okay? And they are, its solution for this guy would be a dispatch. Whereas the solution for this guy would be all dispatches that are feasible. Now, of course, then on top of it, if you start throwing in optimization, then it all, that becomes more interesting. Then the question would be, the solution for this would be all STPs, I mean, you have to give an STP such that every dispatch of that corresponds to, will have the optimal make span, if you are interested in, you know, optimizing the make span. Okay? So the beauty is that PCP is partial order planning, and this is state space planning, which also means that you can, just as you have religious wars in planning as to whether state space planning or partial order planning is good, there are religious wars in scheduling, whether PCP is good or start point representation is good. Okay, and the start point representations are, the proponents of start point representations basically say that, look, if you know the, if you think in terms of start points, you know at every time point how much of every particular resource is being used. So if you have complex resource constraints, complex resource availability constraints, especially multi-capacity, etc., knowing the state information makes it easy to tell whether or not your plan is actually consistent. Okay? PCP is very good for unary capacity problems. Okay? As they become multi-capacity and also fractional capacity resources, etc., PCP doesn't seem to scale as well. Okay, whereas this guy is not, I mean, in fact, the paper I asked you to read is about PCP representation, because that's the one that's sort of not intuitive. You probably would have thought about this right away, and this would probably have taken you some time to think about. And they argue in that paper that PCP scheduling actually, you know, does better on, you know, certain job shop scheduling problems than the start time scheduling. However, most people actually still do this when they have complex resource constraints. For exactly the same reasons you would consider decision epoch planning versus sparse order planning. Okay. Yes. What proof-based?
The proof-based technique for the correctness of the scaling, I mean, these two encodings, it's based on the proof-based technique.
Yeah, but one thing, by the way, I have to tell you the following thing. At the scheduling time, do you need to know why this guy is before this guy? No. That's why you are a shopkeeper. You are like a foreman or forewoman. And the project managers know why this is being done before this guy and this is being done before this guy. They have a causal reasoning. They know that this guy is giving a precondition to this guy and an effect which is used here and another effect which is used here, and this guy is giving another effect which is also used here. That's why they are actually preceding each other. You poor shop foreman or forewoman doesn't need to know. So in a way, scheduling in some sense is model light, in the sense it doesn't need to know why you are scheduling. All you need to know is thou must schedule. You know, these are the requirements. You should not ask me to relax them. And, you know, you should do all these precedences. You should do all these resource constraints. So from the planning point of view, in fact, the correctness of the schedule is only in terms of no constraints are violated. If the original plan is wrong, the correctness of the proof of the various causal link proof, etc., you can't talk about them for schedules. You cannot say why this schedule is correct or not correct. It's out of your ken. Somebody else decided it's correct. It's actually a very important point. That's part of the reason scheduling, you know, somebody else does all the hard work as to whether or not causal connections exist for each of the plans, and somebody else does the rest of the hard work in putting many of these individually causally correct plans into a global schedule. Okay? Now, so that you should see, and you know, I will stop here, and I basically want to point out what the rest of the slides here, which we will talk as needed when you come back next class, which is, you know, 1 week from now. But basically, the rest of the slides are all about two important issues. If you are trying to solve CSP, you need variable and value ordering heuristics, and you need constraint propagation techniques. Okay, so this one is a particular kind of ordering heuristic which takes resource contention into account. Remember, all variable ordering constraint heuristics for all CSPs come from one simple idea. Assign the variable that is most constrained. The question, of course, is what is most constrained? It changes from problem to problem. Okay. And so here, the most constraint is being viewed in this case in terms of what is the region where the resources are most critically constrained. And within that region, what is the activity which is causing most of the contention? And then you take that activity and schedule it first. And that's a variable ordering heuristic. Value ordering heuristic, once you pick a variable, give it the value that is least constraining. That's all you would do. Okay? But, you know, much of scheduling is really variations on this theme. You know, what does it mean to do most constrained variable and least constraining value? This is one idea, which is resource, contention based. Okay? And in terms of constraint propagation, you know, you normally know about arc consistency and forward checking. There are other kinds of ideas. For example, here, if all of these can start between 0 to 12, okay, each of them 0 to 12, they can start, and then each of them have duration of 3 units, then really, and then they have these precedences, then really this guy has to start between 0 and 6, this guy has to start between 3 and 9, this guy has to start between 6 and 12. Right? And that's a constraint propagation. This was obvious from here, but you sort of propagated that into the LST and EFT constraints. This is called the arc bounds propagation. It's sort of like an arc consistency, except in terms of bounds. Okay. Here is a more interesting one. This is called the edge finding propagation, where what you wind up saying is if you have a set of activities and together their duration is not enough to come before this action, then this action must come after the set. Except there are exponential number of sets. So finding, edge finding propagation is useful, but it's very hard to enforce. The reason I'm bringing this up is to make connections to stuff that you already know and seeing, you know, what happens in scheduling. And then, you know, this is just the way the overall system in the PCP scheduler works. You should be able to read the paper, and then we'll talk more about any questions you have. Okay? So we'll stop here. Next class, questions that you have on scheduling, as well as the discussion on the David Smith paper. Okay?